Okay, so I'm Frank Ferrastro. I'm a senior vice president here at CSIS, and I'm senior director of the Energy and National Security Program. And it's my pleasure as kind of the home team this morning to welcome you to this event. We think it's extremely timely. This is a great topic. Obviously, you can tell by the audience turnout that it's an item that's of great interest in this city. We've been playing with natural gas for probably a year and a half, going back to the roadmap that we put together with WRI, Roadmap to a Low-Carbon Economy, recognizing the role that gas can play. It's portable, it's storable. Now with the unconventionals, it's readily available. It's baseload, it's peak, it's compatible with renewables. There's some great benefits to it, but you have to get the policy right. So when Adam Smitsky approached us with the prospect of doing this joint session with the Association of Energy Economics, we thought this would be a great thing to do, in part because we really appreciate the work that the association has done. It also gives us an opportunity to spend some time with folks like Adam and Ben Schlesinger that we always enjoy working with, and because the topic is so good and it's one we had great interest in anyway, we thought this would be a great time to put it together. Now, in the past, some of you have attended, we have done single sessions on technology and the resource base and the economics and the above-ground issues and the security impacts of having domestic supply to change international markets. We've never tried to do all of this in one day, so we're going to see how that works. But I got to tell you, the panelists that have been solicited for their presentations today are just outstanding. I think you're going to get a wide range of perspectives. We've got Bob Simon with us this morning to give us kind of a view from the Hill. We've got Murray Gerber coming at lunchtime and Joe Aldi to kind of close the day, so you'll get a variety of different perspectives. This is one of those opportunities, we think, that the good day in think tank land is when you can actually move the ball forward and put a little different perspective and upgrade the policy debate. Adam was saying this morning that his hope for an expectation for a good turnout today was we got 60 to 100 people and we have an entertaining day. I think on all counts that we will have fulfilled our expectations. Let me welcome you all. There's a couple of administrative things. So first and foremost, out of courtesy to the speakers and also the people around you, since we have a large crowd today, this would be a great time to turn off your cell phones or put them on mute. For those of you that have already availed yourself of the CSIS coffee in the back, you've already probably found the restrooms, which are down the hall and to your left. If not, you will find them shortly. The exits, in the event, the unlikely event of an evacuation, you have a couple of different options. So there's stairwells that are clearly marked going out the doors to my right, to your left. If you go one flight up, it takes you to the foyer behind the elevator bank that takes you out to K Street. If you go one flight down, it takes you to the garage level, follow the ramp up, and you exit on 18th Street. And with that, let me turn this program over to Andy Knox. Andy is the current president of the Washington chapter of the U.S. Association of Energy Economists, and then he can introduce Ben, and Ben will then introduce Bob Simon. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Frank. We are just thrilled to be partnering with CSIS. This is the 14th annual energy policy conference of the national chapter of the U.S. Association of Energy Economics. So this year is focused on gas. As Frank said, it's really one of the pivotal issues in energy policy. So we're just delighted to be having such an exciting panel of speakers all day today. We would like also to just thank CSIS for partnering with us in such a great venue. This is right in the heart of downtown. As you can all see, this is a terrific spot, and we're excited about the turnout as well. I would just like to turn this now over to Ben Schlesinger, a former president of the USAEE local chapter, and soon to be president of the national chapter. Before I do, I also like to thank Adam Smitsky for all of his hard work in organizing this, and also Mark Lively for his work, as well as the folks at CSIS for all that they did. Ben is an international gas market expert. He is often advised leading corporations around the world, as well as spoken in front of Congress many times. So he also has the distinction of being one of the first early adopter of natural gas in his his personal life, being one of the first purchasers of a natural gas vehicle. So with that, I would just turn it over to Min.
Thank you, Andy. I wish I could say I was still that many people had done this, but unfortunately, we still have the only house with natural gas in Maryland after 15 years. It's a real pleasure to introduce Bob Simon, who is staff director, as you know, with Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Bob was formerly held positions with the Department of Energy. You have his bio, and I won't read it. He's been with the Senate for 17 years. He's had a position with the National Research Council, doctorate at MIT in inorganic chemistry, was recently named a fellow of the AAAS, American Academy for American Association for the Advancement of Science. Bob, I've seen Bob at work and spoken with him on the Hill. He's just the kind of person with the experience and skill to craft workable legislation. When you hear about bipartisanship, this is somebody who actually puts it to work and lives it and breathes it. Without another word, thank you so much for being here, Bob.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for that introduction. It's really a pleasure for me to be here this morning for this policy conference on the unconventional gas revolution. As both Frank and the others have said, this is a very interesting and fascinating topic. It's sort of important topic, and this meeting is being looked at today at sort of a pivotal point in our energy policy debate in Washington. It's easy to call it a pivotal point. My only problem is I can't figure out which direction it's pivoting in. But let me start off by talking a little bit about unconventional natural gas, as seen from the Hill perspective, and the sorts of things we're hearing from a wide variety of experts about unconventional natural gas, and asking sort of a few questions that I suspect you're going to get around to exploring today. And as you develop your own sort of consensus about some of these issues, we would be delighted to sort of receive and process some of your conclusions and consensus thoughts from this conference as we move forward on the Hill. First question really deals with the size of the potential supply impact of unconventional natural gas. It's looking like unconventional natural gas is going to be a major new development on the energy policy scene here in the United States, certainly in Canada, elsewhere around the world. The same sorts of geologies that we're exploiting now obviously occur in places like Poland, which are very interesting from sort of a geopolitical natural gas perspective. If there are suddenly major new sources of natural gas supply in Europe, that's a very interesting geopolitical development. Cambridge Energy Research Associates and Dan Juergens' group actually is releasing a report down in Houston this week entitled Fueling North America's Energy Future, which is mostly focused on unconventional natural gas, which they present as a paradigm shift in our energy picture. And why do they sort of, you know, Dan Juergens not the kind of guy who's sort of given to gross exaggeration, so why do they have this highly optimistic view? And they point to some raw supply statistics. They think that we're adding essentially 1,800 a trillion additional cubic feet to a domestic natural resource that's will bring it all to about 3,000 trillion cubic feet, and that's kind of like a 100-year supply. And so I guess one of the first questions is, do people here in the room sort of generally think that's on target? Do they think that's high or low or what? If we're seeing such a large new source of supply coming on board, that would seem to have major implications for what we're doing with liquefied natural gas and even major infrastructure projects like the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline. So does unconventional natural gas take some of these things that, you know, 2 or 3 years ago were seen pretty much as kind of ultimate long-term necessities? Does it make them more options than necessities? I think that's kind of an interesting question for us to deal with in the policy perspective. Obviously, natural gas has a lower carbon footprint per unit of energy produced and unit of energy consumed. So that makes it an attractive candidate for lowering the overall carbon content of our energy system. Now, of course, producing shale gas is not without its own environmental issues, and some of them have gotten a rather intense focus in the debate here in Washington. What sort of context we should put those issues in, I think, is an important question. How do they compare with the environmental issues associated with other major fossil fuel like coal, for example? We are certainly seeing resistance to unconventional natural gas exploration and production in places like New York State, and there are a couple ways of looking at that. Are we looking at a more fundamental sort of technological and political problem that's going to be – may emerge as a showstopper, or are we dealing with the fact that people are beginning to produce a resource in a place that's not seen this kind of resource production ever before, and so there's some sort of learning curve that – local communities and state governments are climbing along the Marcellus Shale Formation, et cetera. And I think that that is an interesting question. And either way, what should our policy response be? I think that's an important question that we're trying to wrap our minds around. If we are bringing new and large and seemingly stable supplies of natural gas online in the United States, does that smooth out price volatility? Price volatility has been quite an issue in natural gas policy over the last several years. Are we going to stabilize around some price point? And if we stabilize around $5 to $7, is that a good price point? What's the implications of that as a sort of a long-term price point for natural gas? Will that be accepted by residential customers and industrial customers? A lot of them are quite price sensitive to natural gas in their operations. And then finally, the sort of the broader question is, what do we do with it if we have all this new gas? And you know, my thought is that it's the most likely outcome is that it's going to find its way mostly into the power and manufacturing sector. But there are other people who have other very different ideas. The thinking that I think we have up on the Hill among some of us is that, look, you know, our existing infrastructure for distributing and using natural gas is pretty much tailored to, you know, the power sector and the manufacturing sector. And there will probably be an increasing demand or role for gas as some sort of transition fuel as we retire coal plants and as a backup fuel for intermittent sources like solar and wind. One way of thinking about a wind farm is sort of a lower carbon footprint version of a natural gas plant, if you could look at it from that perspective. But how does this group see it? Do you sort of see that as being the dominant place that is natural gas is going into? And if you sort of are thinking a little more deeply about the power sector scenario, you know, I think that there are a number of current assertions being made in the policy realm in Washington about natural gas that I think bear some closer examination. We certainly have Tim Wirth, former senator, a good friend, former member of the Energy Committee, certainly a good friend of many members of the Senate, including Senator Bingaman, who are out there saying, look, this is terrific. We can just change the dispatch order for generation and just dispatch natural gas ahead of coal. Presto changeo, you can see I have a little skepticism about this, carbon footprints are instantly and almost immediately reduced. But aren't there a lot of coal plants located in places where there aren't good dispatchable natural gas plants to begin with? And can you really run a peaker like as if it were a baseload plant? And so how realistic? What are the pluses and the minuses? What are the elements of realism and elements of optimism in this sort of dispatch scenario? I think that's a question that we're grappling with here in Washington, and if you've got some sage observations to make on that, I think we'd be very interested in hearing them. And, you know, the second question deals with sort of the long-term future of natural gas. Let's assume for a moment that we convert all our coal plants over to natural gas. Eventually, the emissions curve from that generation mix does intersect the curve we're supposed to come down in order to get to some of these climate change scenarios, like 450 parts per million of carbon dioxide equivalent in the atmosphere. And if that's the case, we probably need to figure out how to make carbon capture and sequestration work for natural gas plants. And I wonder what people in the room think about that. Do people agree with that sort of assessment? That's certainly an assessment that is the International Energy Agency and their 2008 report on energy technology perspectives for getting to major reductions of greenhouse gases, and that was to a 50% reduction target in 2050. And obviously, you know, there are people who think that that's way too weak a target, and we need to get to 60, 70, 83%. So what is the connection ultimately between natural gas and carbon capture and sequestration? There's a different scenario than this sort of power sector scenario I've been talking about, and it's been the subject of also a lot of conversation. It's being actively promoted by natural gas proponents, most notably T. Boone Pickens. And his thesis is that, you know, this gas is just terrific. We can just replace a tremendous amount of other fossil fuels in our transportation system with the direct use of natural gas. Now, we certainly see natural gas used in local fleets and has been for, a decade or more, a couple decades. And it's got a fair degree of market penetration in that sort of specialized sector. But is natural gas sort of a sensible economic candidate for a sort of long-haul of transportation from 18-wheelers? That's what Mr. Pickens is proposing. And if you sort of think about that, there's some, sooner or later we get around to sort of thermodynamics. And compressed natural gas and even liquefied natural gas just has a lower energy content per volume than diesel fuel. So the way I sort of do the math, if your average 18-wheeler with two big diesel tanks can probably drive around 650 miles before it pulls off somewhere, and it probably can refill those tanks in, 5 minutes, 7 minutes. It's not terribly long it's not a terribly long wait on those, fuel plazas off the New Jersey Turnpike. So now, if we're suddenly using the same form factor and using compressed natural gas, maybe you're only going 170 miles before you have to pull off. And, of course, it takes a lot longer to fuel up with compressed natural gas. So you're talking maybe 20 minutes, maybe a little more. Now, is that a problem? How do truckers feel about that, I wonder? And so I do think that there's some practicality issues associated there that aren't entirely clear to us as we evaluate these proposals, and I think that would be worth looking at. And I did bring one slide that Frank is going to figure out how to put up, which sort of gets to this sort of question of sort of thermodynamics. And what this slide is a sort of a whales-to-wheels analysis of the energy efficiency of different kinds of natural gas options for fueling transportation. Okay, so we sort of go from, it's like golf scores, so lower is better. The more this is, the vertical axis is joules per kilometer, so BTUs per mile. So the fewer BTUs or joules you need per unit of distance, sort of the better off you are. So we could take natural gas and turn it into Fischer-Tropsch diesel. We know how to do that. That's a relatively inefficient way of doing it because you have to use up a lot of energy in system-wide from the well to the wheels to actually move very far. And so we kind of go across. Now, let's fuel all the 18-wheelers, that's be spark ignition. So that would be the second item here. And then we sort of come across, we could try to turn natural gas into hydrogen and run it through fuel cells. We can use combustion turbines and then make electricity and put it into plug-in hybrids. And finally, we can use combined cycle plants to put into plug-in hybrids. And you can see that actually from a thermodynamic perspective, turning natural gas into electricity, running it through the wires and into people's light-duty vehicles, is 35% more thermodynamically efficient than just having a compressed natural gas vehicle itself. And there are reasons for that. Obviously, you can burn it at higher temperature and get more thermodynamic efficiency. Electric motors wheel torque is much more efficient than in an automobile. Ignition engine to wheels. And so, there are a number of systems efficiencies that come into play. So when you sort of think about the relative thermodynamic efficiency of your different options, right, does that convey any sort of policy messages to us here in Washington? And should we sort of follow the thermodynamics in terms of how we think about the use of natural gas in transportation or not? So that's kind of a brief tour of some of the high issues that I think come to us most naturally when we talk about natural gas. Like I said, you have a lot of interesting experts on the program today. Sadly, we have a hearing in the committee this morning that I have to go back to, but I do plan to check back in with Adam and Frank to see what your general sentiments were and your insights were on this sort of collections of questions. Let me just say a few things, and I'll try not to go over my time, about sort of where we stand in the sort of larger policy picture at this point in Congress. And the first thing is to sort of note where we are on the diagram. Okay, if you sort of look at the number of session weeks we've had already and the number of session weeks that remain in front of us before October 8th, which I think is kind of the outside for when we adjourn to have people go off and run for re-election, we're sort of at the two-thirds point in this Congress, which is kind of, sort of surprising when you think about it that we're that far gone. And so we don't have a whole lot of time left in this year to settle up on a very impressive array of very thorny issues, only one of which is energy. As was mentioned, the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources, for which I work and which is chaired by my boss, Senator Jeff Bingaman of New Mexico, And is we have the good fortune of having Senator Lisa Murkowski as our ranking member, who has been just a terrifically substantive person to work with, and also sort of has this adheres to the idea that the Senate ought to be a place where we work things out on a bipartisan basis. So we've been able to produce a bipartisan energy bill. We reported it out last June. The American Clean Energy Leadership Act that addresses a number of what we think are the key sticking points in energy policy going forward. And I will sort of group them into sort of five general categories. One is really the search for new policies to accelerate the deployment of clean energy technology. And under that category are things like the Renewable Electricity Standard, our Clean Energy Deployment Administration proposal, and transmission system improvements for siting and deciding on and making sure you can build and figuring out how to pay for improvements to the electric transmission system. The second major theme of our bill is energy efficiency. And there we take a real look at how to improve energy efficiency in the manufacturing sector, which I think is critical to the future health of the manufacturing sector in the United States, as well as energy efficiency in buildings and appliances. The third major theme of our bill really deals with the energy innovation system. And there we've managed to craft sort of a bipartisan agreement on a long-term comprehensive doubling of our energy research and development programs of the Department of Energy, as well as a variety of provisions that deal with energy workforce training, which is sort of critical to the future. I think the fourth general area of enterprise in our bill is things I would call sort of energy market improvements. These deal with a collection of specific issues. For example, do we have an adequate way of ensuring cybersecurity electric transmission system? I mean, that is, if there is a major, information or cyber attack on SCADA systems, we're in deep trouble in this country, and there needs to be a way of detecting and heading those off and responding to threats and vulnerabilities along those lines. Also, the availability of energy supplies when our infrastructures particularly our infrastructure for the delivery of product is disrupted by hurricanes, as we saw with Hurricane Ike, and then the whole issue of do we have really the adequate information on energy market, how energy markets are operating. Where is all this product that seems to be floating in offshore in boats around the world, and who owns it, and when's it coming to shore, and how does that affect our thinking about energy markets going forward? So there's a lot of things that we could do to sort of help energy markets work better, since we do rely on market forces for an awful lot of the specifics of our energy systems operation and energy policy. And finally, the last sort of general category of things that we did on a bipartisan basis in the committee was, I think, comes under the rubric of transition to the future. These are things like opening the Eastern Gulf of Mexico to oil and gas exploration. There's 21 trillion cubic feet of natural gas under the Eastern Gulf. That's just the estimate at this point. It's probably more once you get started and learn more about the geology. And also things like carbon capture and storage, how to sort of get carbon capture and storage projects at a large scale demonstrated, and what are the barriers to that, those kinds of demonstrations, and what can we do from the congressional side to deal with issues like liability, long-term stewardship, the things that keep people from actually signing up for a project and say, yeah, I'll put 1 million tons of CO2 underground a year for 10 years to show that it can be done. You have to ask them the question, well, okay, after 10 years, you've got 10 million tons of CO2 under the ground. Who owns that? You know, who's responsible for that? And I think that there are some issues there that on a policy nature that we can help with. Since reporting the bill, we've continued to work on a bipartisan basis. We have a bunch of hearings this week that are the fruit of that. Senator Bingaman and Senator Murkowski have co-sponsored a very substantial bill containing a number of additional appliance and equipment efficiency standards, including outdoor lighting, including sort of embodying sort of a consensus that has emerged about how to deal with regional standards. There are some real greenhouse gas savings associated with that. Homestar, we'll have a hearing on that this week. And we are soliciting additional suggestions on a bipartisan basis for other sort of perfecting improvements or technical changes that people want to see to our bill, which sort of leads to the question, once you all do that, then what do you do? The path forward on this topic is a little murky at the moment. Senator Reid earlier talked last year of a method of proceeding in which the relevant committees would sort of report out their work product in their areas of jurisdiction, and they would somehow then be integrated with each other. And most of the committees that he initially had sort of nominated for doing that have not reported out legislation. We've reported out a bill. The Environment Public Works Committee has reported out the Kerry Boxer bill, but that was with some attendant controversy. Senators Kerry Graham and Lieberman are circulating around the Senate and talking to a lot of members, trying to see if there is a way of discovering 60 votes for a comprehensive form or a semi-comprehensive form of a cap-and-trade system. That continues to be a work in progress. They haven't circulated a text yet. We're hopeful that they will in the near future, and I think once there's a text out there, it'll be a little easier to see whether they have come up with something that can get sort of the necessary support to advance in the Senate. Obviously, Senator Byron Dorgan, Kent Conrad, and a number of others have advocated for, just take the energy bill that we passed and sort of be done with it and push that through. Obviously, Senator Bingaman certainly supports the bill that we reported out of committee. I would sort of characterize, if I had to sort of come up with a quick sobriquet for his point of view, I think it wouldn't be energy only, be energy plus. I think that he does believe that there are a variety of other policies that we can probably get broad consensual support for in the Senate that would be very responsive to the need to get our arms around the greenhouse gas problem. We're certainly talking to a variety of members about that. The activities that ongoing activities in our committee are one example of that. But ultimately, as Senator Bennett Johnson, my first boss on the Hill, used to say, sometimes the clock is your enemy. And at this point, I think that the clock is our enemy. We don't have a lot of time left. We have a very full agenda. I think, happily, the president does have energy near the top of his agenda. Obviously, health care is the top of his agenda. But energy and climate are not too far behind. So you'll have Joe Aldi coming to sort of wrap this up, and I'm sure he'll have more to say about the president's views. The White House continues to reach out to members on the Hill, including my boss, to actually reaching out on a bipartisan basis to try to assess where we are and what can get done. So there's a lot of ferment. We'll hope that all translates into some significant accomplishments in this Congress. So with that, I appreciate you having me, and I've only put you 5 minutes behind schedule. So thanks a lot.
Bob, thanks. We have no time, but we should take a question or two. If you have a question, please raise your hand and wait for the mic to get to you. We're audio recording, and so it won't do you any good if we have a hand up here. Please, is there a mic? And please state your name and affiliation.
Bob McNally. Hello? Bob McNally with the Rapid End Group. Bob, excellent talk. A question for you. Could you elaborate a little bit on the politics of clean water that's around the fracking issue? And specifically, would you care to put odds on the likelihood that the exemption fracking enjoys under the Safe Drinking Water Act will be in place, say, by the end of next year? Thank you.
Well, it's always hard to prognosticate how Congress will deal with any particular issue. There are a variety of viewpoints on all of them. I will observe that when the House was considering its comprehensive energy and climate bill, this was a topic that they looked at, but then decided that they weren't quite ready to address. And so I think that if we sort of have to start looking for data that would sort of illuminate what might be going on. Obviously, we have a bill. Senator Casey's introduced a bill on the topic here in the Senate. We certainly have had a lot of briefings to try to educate people on the topic. I certainly have been in briefings from advocates on various sides. I've been in with advocates of people who think we ought to do something, who, sort of talk about sort of various disturbing stories of people who've had their groundwater contaminated allegedly by fracking. I think that it's that's a very complicated topic, and it's the data there is certainly kind of murky. And you, when people sort of say that the groundwater has been contaminated, oftentimes, you know, people, and we have lots of people, you know, who live up next to oil and gas operations in New Mexico. There are a lot of practices that happen in the process of drilling for, you know, exploratory wells, drilling, you know, production wells, producing from wells, other than fracking, that in my own thinking seem to be much more likely candidates for potential source terms of contaminants in groundwater. And you know, and I think that there's certainly an issue out there, particularly with older wells, about whether there's, you know, whether there's the cement on the borehole is adequate, whether that was, you know, and the problem, of course, is that, you know, in the oil and gas industry, we have, you know, people tend to think of it as just only a couple majors, but obviously in the onshore in the United States, we have a wide variety of operators, some of whom are just terrific, and some of whom sort of leave a lot to be desired. Okay, so it's sort of a complicated question, I think, to confidently assign any one cause to instances of groundwater contamination. People see unusual chemicals showing up in their wells. Well, were they from the drilling mud? I mean, you know, how do you know it was from the fracking thing? Now, I do think that one of the issues in the politics of all of this is sort of the what I would call the mystery quotient. I mean, I think people make a lot of statements that, you know, nobody has any possible idea of what's going down, toxic witches brews people are injecting 7,000 feet into the ground, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that a little bit of that's overstated because I'm fairly well convinced that people actually have material safety data sheets on the site that outline what some of these things are. I do think that trying to address this kind of mystery quotient part of it is probably would be a helpful thing for industry to do. I mean, the chemical industry faced this issue 20 years ago in the aftermath of Bhopal. And they took some strong action to, you know, assure the public that they could find out what was going on at chemical processing plants, you know, and they were able to find ways of doing it that obviously did not, you know, harm their ability to continue to undertake proprietary activities. I do think that that's certainly one dimension to pursue going forward in all of this. But like I said, it's a complicated topic. If we ever get around to debating an energy or climate bill on the Senate floor, you know, those bills will probably be open to amendment. So it's always the possible subject of an amendment. We're doing what we can in the Energy Committee to sort of understand the dimensions of the problem ourselves and to sort of serve as a sort of a technical resource to help other people understand sort of the technical dimensions of the problem.
Thank you, Bob. It's a real pleasure. Bob, thank you so much for being here, presenting you with a certificate of our appreciation.
Oh, thank you.
For appearing today in our hearing.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I look forward to what you come up with.
I'd like to go ahead and roll right into our first panel. Raoul LeBlanc, can you please have your panelists come up? And I'll.
Sure.
We can also probably get signs. Thank you. The signs are... Signs are coming up at some point. Great. So our speakers are here. Until your signs are here, just turn the ones down unless you want to appear as one of these guys. I'll just briefly introduce the moderator of the first panel. Raoul LeBlanc is a senior director of PFC Energy's Energy Financial Advisory practice. He's got 15 years experience, was with Anadarko Petroleum for a number of years, as well as ESAI, Energy Security Analysts. He's a graduate of Georgetown and the Johns Hopkins SAIS program. Raoul, thank you so much for agreeing to moderate. And
great. I want to get started because we have a lot to cover here. What we want to do in this first panel is set up the basic framework for a lot of today's discussion, and we have essentially three parts. Velo is going to talk about how much is out there. Jen is going to talk about what it costs and what it takes to get it out. And then Mike is going to talk about the great work that has happened on the surface sector side to allow this revolution to happen. So without any further ado, Velo.
Good morning. It's a real pleasure to be here. I've incorporated the word revolution into my title, but really the the word I'd like to use and have been using for some time has been a paradigm shift. And in our view, this paradigm shift is underway as we truly begin to understand how large a resource is and how affordable. Now, this paradigm shift or revolution has just caught the public's eye really in about the last year or two. But it's been underway for some time. It started really more than a decade ago, and low cost, in fact, at that time, it was really the lowest cost natural gas supply, was the coal bed methane in the San Juan Basin of New Mexico. And next came really the very highly productive wells in Wyoming, in Pinedale, and Jonah. And now, really, it's kind of the third leg of the stool, the gas shales, starting with the Barnett Shale and now moving to all of the other large basins. So with that, and it's really been this last third stool that has, third leg of the stool that has really brought all of this attention together, and it really does raise a question, gas shales, what's the big deal? I just want to quote a couple of people, Fred Julander, very active in the natural gas area out of the Rockies. It's quite a statement. Shale gas is the most important energy development since the discovery of oil. ASPO, you know, the Association for Study of Peak Oil, which tends to be a rather somewhat pessimistic crowd in the spectrum of energy analysis, actually did a fairly, what I would call, optimistic article on Mission Critical, Can Gas Shale Save the World? And then in line with the movement of this revolution from the North America into Europe and the rest of the world, the Sunday Times had a great article called Shale Gas Blast Open World Energy Market. So this gives you a bit of an insight that the topic is broader than just here in North America. Now, in my view, if we're going to fully capitalize on the ability to use natural gas, particularly gas shales, as part of a pathway to a low-carbon future, we need to address three questions. I'm going to spend most of my time on question one, but I do want to which is, are there adequate supplies? And we do a lot, as a firm, we do a lot of very fundamental work, basin-level work, from the ground up, from logs, from reservoir engineering approaches to determine how much is there, how much is recoverable, and what will it cost. But I will want to touch a little bit on the second two topics. They'll be covered in more depth the rest of the panel and later on today, the role of technology. And this is a technology play. We've basically, with R&D support provided by Department of Energy, gas research, and tremendous investments by industry have basically what I call cracked the technology code. But there's, as I'll touch on later, we have quite a ways to go to make the entire resource, as much of the resource as possible, economic. And then the question, of course, as was already introduced to Bob Simon, can these new natural gas resources be developed in an environmentally sound way? I want to talk about a couple of the green development practices that industry has adopted. There are others, of course, that need to be undertaken. So just as a brief introduction, what is it? How does it differ, unconventional gas? Basically, there are three things that distinguish it. One is these deposits are continuous. They go over fairways and basin rather than discrete traps like conventional gas. I give you a quick perspective of why can unconventional gas be so much larger. Second is it's geologically complicated, much more so, many orders more so than conventional gas. And then for the first time, and particularly as we go into first into coal beds and gas shales, they're the whole package. They're both the gas source, basically trap, and a reservoir as opposed to in conventional gas, three distinct elements that have to come together to have a field. Now, how much do we have? Well, if we're now just talking about gas shales, basically we're right about now around 10 BCF a day. It's grown tenfold since the start of the decade. The big contributor, of course, is the Barnett Shale. It's about half of it right now. But coming on strong are the other major basins, the Haynesville, the Marcellus, the Woodford, and the Fayetteville. And then there are others, Antrim and the Devonian and so on, that make that nice blue wedge at the very bottom. How large is it? Well, I guess my first answer is we don't truly yet know. There's a lot of work to be done. We've looked at what I call the Magnificent Seven of North American gas shale basins. And we both try to establish how much is in place and then go through a fairly rigorous approach to establish how, on a risk basis, how much is of that is recoverable. And for the five U.S. basins, over 3,000 TCF in place. Of that, we have about 470 that's recoverable. I'll talk a little more details about it. And in Canada, we've looked at in-depth at two basins. Basically, the size there is of those basins, about 1,400 TCF, 240 TCF recoverable. Now, we're continuing to work in this area. We've recently finished the Eagle Ford Shale. It's another, it probably, I'll have to call this kind of quickly the Magnificent Eight or so in a minute. The Bossier Shales, recently we finished work up in Canada on the Utica Shales, and starting on the massive Colorado Shales that aerially are probably the largest of all, but probably one of the more difficult. So these numbers will change over time. But I like to put out numbers in which we have foundation, and it's original work that we do, so that when I speak to people like you, you have some confidence that it's real, and there's real data behind it. So here are five of the Magnificent Seven. I won't drag you through each of those. The map basically shows the level of production as an exit rate in 2009, and basically, this breaks out the resource endowment running from the Barnett through the Marcellus. Of the 3,400, the big one in terms of resource in place is the Marcellus. If one wants to be more optimistic, that number could be larger. But most of the development to date has been the Barnett. But the Barnett has quite a long way to go. I'm actually quite actively involved in the Fayetteville Shale. I serve on the board of directors of the major company that developed it starting about 6 years ago, Southwestern Energy itself, and then some of the newer plays that are coming on. Now, gas shales are the most visible. They're the ones that are being written up in the Financial Times article yesterday and in other articles that appeared, but it's really only one of the three. And coal bed methane, I mentioned the mighty San Juan Basin, provides about 5 BCF a day currently, about half of what shales contribute, and it's been stable at that level for quite some time. The biggest source is still tight gas. It's particularly in the Rockies, but now increasingly in the mid-continent and in Texas areas. It provides about double of what gas shales provide, 18 BCF a day. So we put all of these together and kind of took a projection into the future, and which I'll show you in a second, and we look for about a 50% growth in the production of all three of these sources, driven heavily by gas shales itself. And at that point, at the 2020, we look for these resources to provide somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of North American natural gas production. And here, basically, you can see in the green wedge, you see the growth in gas shales. and pretty fairly steady in coal bed methane, and then the very important tight gas. And we basically did this projection under two assumptions. One is that there is a market, and second is that gas prices would be on the order of $7 and a million BTUs. Now, if you kind of integrate the forecast, you quickly see that it goes nowhere near consuming the resource that's available. There's a lot of resource that is not economic at $7, and even a larger resource that we basically risk such that it doesn't even yet enter the recoverable resource base. And so technology is critical here. And this has been quite a success story. The Department of Energy basically built the initial scientific understanding of these resources. Gas research industry and industry did the field demos to show it could be done. And it's also a policy success in that Section 29 brought the capital, brought the interest, allowed the smaller players who really made this an industry to basically attract capital and develop the resource. But we're a long way. We're still in the early propeller stages, if I can use that analog of the airline industry, in terms of the technologies that are available. Well, I know we're going to get a great talk both in terms of horizontal wells and fracturing. I just want to basically make a major point. You know, we've been developing gas shales in Appalachia and Michigan for a number of decades. And these were the shallow formations which had natural fractures, and nature helped us to produce those. What changed the game was that after the Barnett Shale was developed, we began to understand we could actually create a reservoir. And these deep shales, which otherwise remained unproductive. And so it was this breakthrough, both in knowledge and then the technologies that came along that allowed us to implement that knowledge, that brought on shales and made the Barnett Shale the largest gas field in Texas, and soon the Haynesville and the Marcellus Shales, some of the largest gas fields in the world. And progress continues. Now, this is probably, if you're a producer, probably one of the more critical slides, in that our prior perceptions were that unconventional gas was on the upper end of the price supply curve. And what has really changed, and particularly with the technologies and our understanding of this resource, it's now the low-cost part of the supply curve. So, and you can see that the fact that this is really where the rigs are headed, particularly in this lower-price world. And that has really made all of the difference. And then you can see why companies like Exxon and Shell are now need to enter this market. Otherwise, they would be basically priced out. And then finally, last topic, and again, I'll touch on this very lightly, a harsh spotlight will fall as more and more development goes on, and what I call green development can basically make this a more environmentally friendly activity. I'm only going to touch a couple of these: surface impacts, methane emissions. Later on, you'll hear about water, you'll hear about fracking, and so on. But this is one that, to many people, is the most visible type of environmental impact, land use, and tremendous progress on multi-well pads, horizontal wells, that can reduce what you might otherwise drill 8 to 16 wells in a square mile. You now can do that with just one well pad, and everything else takes place underground. In fact, Williams Company has really pushed this to an extreme in the Rockies, very environmentally sensitive areas, 22 wells basically from one single pad. And then finally, I think this is something that's going to continue to emerge. The question is, clearly methane is a greenhouse gas. Can you develop this resource in a way without emissions? And I'm just putting up a nice chart that work that the EPA is doing on their Natural Gas STAR program. They basically eliminated over 500 BCF of methane emissions from the sector and brought about this really understanding that you can actually make money here. And Williams, Devon, many of the others active here, they basically put in a system to capture their emissions. They sold that gas for about $159 million. It only cost them $17 million to do that. So this is, in our view, many of these things, capturing methane emissions, recycling water, reducing land impacts, are actually a smart economic thing to do. It's just the information needs to get out there and show how it's done. So with that, let me conclude and stay within my allotted time. Basically, the three points in my presentation, the work we've done shows that we do have a large supply of gas shales, unconventional gas. These numbers will grow with time as we understand more about the basins and develop the technologies to be more efficient. Second, technology can keep these supplies affordable. Encouraging their greater use in power generation, transport, and with green development, they can be developed in an environmentally sound way. Thank you very much.
All right, good. Now we'll hear from Jennifer from Wood Mackenzie about the economics. Go ahead, I'll get you fired
up. Got my slides up?
Yeah.
And we definitely agree that the true paradigm shift driven by this shale gas development of the resource base and as well cost declines achieved by the producers really came about and really was recognized in 2009. We actually turned around North American gas production between 2007 and 2008, but only really last year, as drilling declined precipitously and yet our production levels held up, and as the repeatability of the shale success story extended into different basins, and most importantly, as cost declines really took hold in these shale gas basins, was the paradigm recognized. And sometimes we throw out terms like paradigm shift, perfect storm, and now black swan a little bit lightly. But truly, we are thinking very differently now about the long-term potential for North American gas markets, about competitive commodity pricing, and indeed the ultimate supply picture within North America because of not only the establishment of this resource base and the turnaround in North American production, but importantly because of the cost declines achieved by producers as they've cracked that technological code and continue to come along the learning curve associated with delivering shale gas in particular to market, and now with some of those techniques extended into tight gas plays. And let's flip down. And I promise all of you in the room, I did not know that Velo sat on the board of Southwestern Energy when I put this slide together. It is, in fact, the slide that we typically use to talk about the cost declines that producers have achieved as they've built to scale and as they've really perfected the technologies needed to deliver shale gas resources to market. And what I'm showing are the cost declines in development break-evens in the Fayetteville Shale achieved by Southwestern, which is basically 75% of the production in the Fayetteville, over a three-year period from the end of 2006 through the end of 2008 and into the beginning of 2009. And essentially, as the company came along the learning curve, drilled more and more wells, and came through a real technological feedback effect, as they learned about the best completion technique, as they built operations to scale, and importantly, in 2008, moved to pad drilling, they were able to bring the break-even costs in the Fayetteville down from around $5 per MMBTU in that 2007 timeframe down to the mid-$3 range by the beginning of 2009. Now, this is an impressive achievement in any cost environment, but it's actually much more impressive when you consider that virtually every segment of the energy value chain was under tremendous inflationary pressure during the period 2007 through 2008. And nonetheless, we were able to kind of follow a different trend in terms of these shale break-even costs. So when the shale resource base really took hold and shale drilling took off and actually continued through lower price cycles in the end of 2008 as gas prices dropped and through 2009 as gas prices dropped, a lot of folks looked at these drilling operations as supported only by positive hedges by the producing companies or potentially the need to continue drilling to hold leases. But in fact, what we've seen is that the cost decline actually makes these drilling programs economic in their own right. And one of the points I mentioned is moving to pad drilling, and lately when I've been talking about pad drilling, I've gotten questions in the room about what exactly it is. It's simply going to a rig that can move itself around and essentially cut the time necessary between drilling these different highly productive wells that have been optimized by producers over time, and essentially to cut the time between well delivery, and thus, because of the efficiencies gained in moving to pad drilling, cut the development break-even costs associated with bringing this gas to market. And typically, as these shale gas plays emerge and over their first phases of development, operators will achieve significant cost savings as they move to pad drilling once they've got their lease holdings established. And I've given the Fayetteville Shale development break-even declines as a leading example of cost declines achieved by a large operator moving to scale and perfecting their completion techniques. But in fact, we're seeing this kind of technological feedback among different producers working on different shale plays across the board. And the example I'm showing here are cost declines achieved within the Marcellus shale plays, not by a single operator, but rather by a group of operators between 2007 and 2010. And given innovations like moving to the pad drilling, moving to different frack stages, perfecting completion techniques, and then finally optimizing their production processes, we saw drilling and completion costs per well, again, in a relatively inflationary environment, basically cut in half between 2007 and our early estimates for 2010. So again, very impressive, even on the surface, and more impressive when you consider some of the cost pressures in place within the environment. So as well, in the Marcellus as in the Fayetteville, our development break-evens have come down to the point that these plays are, on a standalone basis, extremely competitive. And Velo talked about the magnificent seven shale plays, which may soon be the grade eight, or we'll have to think of a descriptor for nine. But in fact, these plays that we considered as high cost and relatively challenging to develop even a couple years back have now moved to the bottom or toward the bottom of our North American unconventional supply stack. And this is the eye chart portion of my presentation, but just to give some flavor around the chart, and I'm not sure how well you can see it from the audience, this is a host of unconventional gas plays within the U.S. and Canada that were in some stage of relatively aggressive development back in 2007, 2008. And what we've seen is that the shale plays, and in particular the commercial shale plays and the core areas of these shale plays, have really moved toward the bottom of the unconventional supply stack. And in particular, our three most economic shale plays, the Barnett core area, the Marcellus, which, as we've shown, has really come down in its costs since early in its development in 2007-2008, the Montney play, which is technically more of a tight gas play, but is being developed using shale gas techniques, and as well the Fayetteville shale, have really seen development break-evens fall down to the $4 per MMBTU type level. And again, these are economic in their own right, support continued aggressive drilling and investment as the costs continue to come down, even in a $5 to $6 type pricing environment. And some of the plays that looked so promising even 2 years ago, such as Peon's drilling in the Rockies, Bossier tight gas, Austin Chalk tight gas, are simply moved to the top of the cost stack and just can attract any capital given the superior economics and production characteristics of the shale gas supplies. So a real change relative to the way we historically thought about that shale gas resource base, and a real change in terms of how much gas we can develop in that kind of $5 to $6 per MMBTU type price environment because of the improvements made in these shales. However, the one caveat I'll give is that we tend to put a lot of focus now on the development break-even costs associated with some of the best leading producers within these shales, and as well some of the core acreage within those shales as well. And I'd point out and note that within any of these shales, there will be a range and distribution of performance. Barnett core development break-evens under $4 per MMBTU, but as we move to the non-core areas, the southwest portion of the Barnett, our break-evens are still in the mid-$5 per MMBTU range, even in a low-price environment in 2009. And we still really are learning about the extent of the core areas, and we're still kind of figuring out just how much of the acreage can be developed at these very low break-even costs. And, for example, with the Haynesville Shale, we're basically a year into aggressive drilling, and we're pushing up toward a BCF per day of production in that area. We've established two Tier 1 areas in northwest Louisiana, but there's a real question about the ultimate size of the core and economics away from those two core areas. And in particular, we've still got a lot of difference between the best wells being drilled on the Texas side of the border and the worst wells. So we still really are figuring out all the variables around this different cost base. But nonetheless, you know, even with a relatively conservative expectation on the core size of the Haynesville, we're still watching for production from that play itself to move up towards 6 BCF per day by 2020, so relatively staggering growth. Now, the other caveat I give in terms of talking through some of these cost improvements that producers have been able to achieve and the kinds of cost improvements that are possible as producers move into a new area and experiment with lateral lengths, experiment with different completion techniques, is that cost pressures can move in the other direction as well. And in particular in the Haynesville, it's a very deep play under very high pressure and very high temperatures. And as a result, what we saw early in the development of the play was that a lot of the bottom hole equipment had a very short life, and it tended to slow down drilling programs because the equipment needed to be replaced relatively quickly within the life of the drilling programs. And what we've seen is some real improvement in terms of that bottom hole equipment that has essentially sped up and improved the economics over the last year as we've moved toward that BCF per day of production growth. But the one caveat I'd give is that we are right now in 2009 and into 2010 in one of the lowest cost environments we're likely to see within the energy sector. So our utilization rates, our call on rigs is relatively low. Even the high-spec, very productive rigs right now targeting these shale gas resources, utilization rates are only around 85%. As well, steel costs, diesel costs, labor costs are all relatively low. And so as we move into a higher-priced, higher-demand growth type environment, some of these cost numbers are likely to reverse, and we can't necessarily lose sight of that. And particularly in a place like the Haynesville, where there is a relatively high technological requirement on the equipment. So watch that space as well. We've achieved these tremendous cost declines, but as the industry moves back in toward a period of growth over the next few years, we could see some of those costs improvements reverse, not necessarily because of changes in the well productivity or anything else, but rather changes in the economy as a whole and a faster growth pace within the industry, higher service margins, higher service costs, et cetera. And just to quickly note, because of those cost declines, we expect a tremendous growth coming on our overall shale gas production levels. I think the numbers I'm going to quote are similar to the numbers Velo talked about. We're looking to increase shale production from that magnificent 7 from about 9 BCF per day toward about 17 BCF per day in 2015. And by 2020, we're looking at shale gas production alone within North America moving up toward 25 BCF per day. Now, eventually, this growth, explosive growth in shale gas supply leads to a turnaround in overall North American gas production, but we actually expect overall production levels to fall into decline over the next couple of years despite this tremendous resource base, because we simply don't have market in which to deliver the gas or in which to absorb the gas. And as well, we're facing a real fierce competition coming in the next few years with LNG, because we're developing nearly 12 BCF per day of global liquefaction capacity. Other markets simply can't absorb all the new supplies coming online, and thus we're likely to see a period of relatively low demand over the next few years, and also a lot of competition on the supply side with LNG. Thus, even with that significant shale gas growth, we nonetheless expect to see a bit of a decline in overall North American production before the industry really turns around and we have the opportunity to aggressively drill not just the shales but some of the tight gas plays we talked about that are uneconomic right now and kind of sitting on the sidelines waiting for a firmer market opportunity. And that trend really starts to turn around in 2012-2013. It's driven by LNG, as I mentioned, and also by the trends we expect in the power sector. Our power expectations are outlined in blue on the right-hand side of the chart. Over the next few years, not only are we adding global liquefaction capacity, we're also building a significant number of new coal-fired generation capacity, coal-fired plants that were approved and got their financing and came under construction in 2001, 2002 when we were running out of gas. You know, same deal with the liquefaction plants when we had these real questions around the long-term North American supply base. We invested in coal plants. We invested in global LNG targeting North America. And as a result, as these new coal plants come online, our gas demand from the power sector is likely to fall, even though the economy is growing. Once we finish those coal plants, 2012, 2013, we again move into a period of growth, and that enables a turnaround within the industry. So shale gas grows all along, but by 2012, 2013, we have the opportunity to drill not only the core areas, but some of the more higher cost areas and those tight gas supplies that are on the sidelines now. Now, the last two points I'd like to make, and this is, you know, possibly another eye chart portion of my presentation, but I also wanted to throw out a brief caveat in terms of those costs. So as noted, over this year, we're looking at tremendous improvements in shale break-even costs. And the first shale resource play on my list under key marginal supply sources. So these are the areas where we expect producers to come in and out aggressively or more aggressively, depending on what the price signals in the market look like, is Barnett Southwest shale gas. So producers have been able to continue investing economically in the core areas of the Barnett, even in the low price environment, but in some of the non-core areas where costs are a little more challenging, wells don't quite have the superior economics or recoverable resources as the core area, break-evens are in the high $4 per MMBTU range. So we put them in the kind of $4.75 to $5 break-even type range, non-core Barnett. By 2015, with a more aggressive development pace within the industry, with stronger demand growth, with less competition from LNG, higher service margins, higher steel costs, labor costs, et cetera, we're probably looking at a break-even cost in that Barnett non-core that's more in the $6 to $6.50 per MMBTU range. Okay, so costs, technology advancements continue, yet some of these cost trends look like they could become challenging as the market recovers. And just to wrap up, a huge and positive story in terms of the recoverable shale resource base and unconventional resource base we've established, a tremendous breakthroughs in terms of producers coming along that technological learning curve, getting the completion techniques right, bringing their economics down after the first 100 wells, moving to the next 100 wells, a tremendous base of experience to be applied now across some of these new shales that producers are beginning to pioneer. And also we're seeing some of these shale development techniques being applied to tight gas to improve the economics there. And we have seen the paradigm shift within North American gas markets. We are looking at these markets differently, and certainly on the supply side, the long-term potential of the North American gas resource base is well established given what we've seen happen over the last year. However, we've got a real big question on the the market side. Because although we've established that supply side opportunity, we haven't necessarily figured out the best application or the best place in which to place this new, very competitive gas. And so what we've done on this last chart, which is a bit of a work in progress, is to look at some of the potential markets for this gas, you know, again, given a long-term price expectation and kind of the $6 to $7 per MMBTU range, with more potential given the technological improvements still underway. And what we've looked at on the bottom axis is capital investment required to realize this demand potential. And it goes actually in maybe the reverse of what you're used to. It goes from significant capital investment down to minimal. All right, so the top right-hand side of the chart is kind of the home run in terms of growing gas demand without significant capital commitment. And the time horizon goes from long to short. So, again, the real positive potential is in the top right. And certainly first on the list is coal retirements, because we have essentially an underutilized fleet of gas-fired combined cycle units. We've overbuilt pipeline capacity. We have the capacity to displace coal or to handle coal retirements and add gas demand and generate more investment within this gas resource base in a relatively short period of time. Carbonville, longer period of time, more capital investment necessary. NGVs, significant capital necessary because, as noted, we can relatively easily apply natural gas to CNG, local fleets, fixed route return to base applications. But the holy grail in terms of growing gas demand is really competing for that long-haul trucking market. We can't necessarily do it with CNG. LNG has potential, but it's significantly more expensive. So a good bit of capital investment required, a relatively long time horizon to bring about the kind of change we need, just given the number of large fleet vehicles sold on a year-to-year basis. Industrial market is another one, and that's a question mark we're looking at now in terms of the petrochemical industry. And just one last comment, and then I'll have it wrapped up. Just talking to some contacts in the chemicals industry, they said if you look at forward gas prices and assess political risk realistically right now globally, the best place to site new petrochemical capacity is probably the U.S. Gulf Coast. Now, we're still, you know, coming to terms a bit with this new gas resource base. It might take the next generation of CEOs to actually make those investments, and it's probably 10 to 15 years down the road, but nonetheless is a shining example of the true paradigm shift underway within North American gas markets. Thanks.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. As Velo said, he started with the word revolution, and the word I chose to use was the evolution. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the evolution and continuing that evolution as we go into the future. What I'd like to do is provide a very high-level overview of some of the activities that go on in our industry. There's no way within the time allotted I could spend a day on each one of these to go into it, but what I hope happens is it broadens your perspective of the technical paralysis it takes in not only drilling an oil and gas well, but also in making a field commercial as we go forward. The very first wells, gas wells that were drilled in the Northeast. The first pipelines came shortly thereafter. The first well, oddly enough, was a shale gas well. I think these early pioneers ran into many of the same challenges that we face today. They had trouble getting budgets and the like, and we find the same kind of issues as we move forward. But through their perseverance and through innovation, they were able to overcome the obstacles that they had. And through this, they actually created the natural gas evolution that we're seeing today. Our forefathers never could have imagined the industry today. Everybody's well aware of the vast amount of shale plays that are growing both here in the U.S. and Canada and other places around the world. But those forefathers never could have imagined the extensiveness of the plays that we've got in front of us. Each one of the plays have got very unique characteristics. A lot of people think of these shale plays as just like a blanket that's laid down. Now, if it were a sandy beach or something that was deposited, you know, tens of millions of years ago, you'd have nice flow channels and the like, and that's a conventional reservoir. But the unconventional plays, they've got a lot of geologic anomalies. What you drill into in one section may not fit what you drill into the other. So you've got to have very sophisticated tools and technologies that allow you to determine exactly where to drill when you're drilling in the shale plays going forward. But what's fortunate is that we've had 190 years since those early wells that were drilled with the technology evolutions and the application of those technologies. When you look at the Barnett Shale, it was discovered in the early 80s. It took it several decades of trying different techniques and everything before it became commercial. And then somewhere around 2000 or so, the well started coming in, and they actually started development of the play. Now, what was wonderful about that is that the techniques that were used in the Barnett have actually helped catapult a lot of the other shales that are in place. So the learnings that the industry has put in place in those early years has actually helped plays like the Marcellus and the like to develop. When you look at the basic design when you go into development of a field, they have what they call a field development plan that they create. And in the early stages, they'll actually model how they want to drill, how they want to produce the wells. They'll try to anticipate what's the optimum designs going forward with their well construction and the like that's out there. They may incorporate seismic data if it's available and other pieces that are in there. And then they start with a well construction process. As they drill the wells, they'll go through evaluation. Based on that evaluation, you'll have completions that are put into place. And then from there, you end up with a production side of it. Now, each one of these boxes, I could spend a day talking about each one of them. There are multiple facets to each one of the areas that are there, and there are a lot of strong disciplines in each one of those. But the key piece of the shale development as you go through, you know, we hear a lot about horizontal drilling, we hear a lot about hydraulic fracturing, but the reality is it's the integration of all these pieces. Taking all these disciplines today and make a step change in how we can take the information that we get and apply it to the next wellbore that we're fixing to drill. That's a key principle in what we've done. Without that, the shales wouldn't be economic today. You know, when you look at the well construction side of it, there have been tremendous advancements in rigs and bit technologies, the type fluids that we use, bottom hole assemblies, and the like. And it's through the innovations that's been in the well construction piece that our shales are actually commercial today as we move forward. When you look at a specific part of the well construction piece, when you look at directional drilling, I would say imagine, if you will, being able to take a downhole tool that maybe costs $1 million. It's made out of exotic materials. It's assembled in a clinical-type atmosphere because of the nuances that it's got. You don't have very much real estate in a 4-inch tool, and you're trying to put a lot of hardware into it. Now, imagine on the surface you've got drilling engineers that have got years of technical training and experience, and they're taking this tool and they're putting it deep into the earth. It may be 10,000 feet deep, and at that point they decide that they want to kick off and drill a horizontal lateral extending out from that. As they drill that, what they're looking for in the directional drilling piece is that you've got a geometric design that they're trying to hit. They've got a specific target that may be 5,000 feet out or 10,000 feet out, but it's an XYZ coordinate that they've got when they're doing that. What's fascinating to me is that the ability for these people on the surface to read the small changes in mud pulses to tell exactly where the downhole tool is. But what's also amazing is that they can take these tools and they can put them in place, and with very close proximity, they can hit the XYZ targets they're looking at. You know, you consider 2 miles down and maybe a mile or so across. It's just amazing what they can do. In addition to doing that, we've also got tools that we have that are logging-wide drilling, or we've also got wireline tools that we can do. So when you're looking at that formation, again, taking the fact that you've got this huge blanket out there, and when you start making that horizontal and you're trying to drill through it, every foot or every 10 feet, the formation could be changing. Every 50 feet, it could be changing. You need to know that and understand that on the surface as you're going, because you've got millions of dollars invested in this well that you're trying to drill and to achieve the plan that you had in place. Well, as you start working this thing, you can actually take the cuttings that are returning back to the surface. They do a geochemical analysis. They'll tell the type rocks. Are the type rocks that you're hitting and encountering exactly what you thought you were? And, again, that's interwoven into the process that helps them drill the wellbore. And through this process of taking the geologic information that they've got and putting that with the geometric information that they've got the ability now to where they can put well bores in place in a short period of time in a cost-effective manner. Then what they'll do is they'll take this information based on the well information that they've got after they've drilled the hole, and they design a completion technique. And that's simply putting certain jewelry, as we call it, downhole, that allows you to produce the formation in a very specific way and work it over in the future and the like. But it's all that information, it's all that integration that it's allowed that to happen. Now, stepping away from the wellbore, imagine, if you will, being able to take state-of-the-art computing horsepower, taking very sophisticated modeling and huge databases, and before you ever drill a well, taking information that you've gotten from seismic and other activities and actually constructing in a 3D version what your field will look like when you complete it. They look at everything from well trajectories, how they put them in place. They'll look at issues like how were your well bores produced, the formation, and the like. And you build that all before you even construct a well bore. You've got the possibility to do that. And when you take that information that you've got and you start drilling, you can actually feed in a real-time basis. Imagine being able to take the directional drilling information that you've got or the LWE information that you've got and actually tying that back into this cube that you've built to optimize the next length of well bore that you're drilling or the next well that you have or to see the effects that this well had on the production that you've got. These are the kind of things that the industry is starting to evolve into. Now, if you get back to the wellhead, imagine being able to take the same kind of computing horsepower that you have and tie that to geophones that are strategically placed around a well bore. And these geophones are sensitive devices. They can actually determine nano-level changes in the earth. And through that, what you can actually do is paint a real-time picture going into the future. We're not quite there yet, but you can paint a real-time picture of the actual frack job. So you could picture a time in the not-too-distant future where you could actually take real-time information, plug it into your frack job, and as you're developing the frack, actually modifying the frack job on the surface to optimally recover the hydrocarbons that you have in place on that formation. Through pieces like this, we're going to be able to change our environmental footprint. All right, we're going to be able to take the modeling that we've got, the integration of the various technologies that we have, and then as we go into the future, we're going to say, you know what, we may not need as much of a large footprint on location. We'll be able to drastically change what the surface looks like as we go forward. You can imagine people think about the mechanical pieces that's out there, but there's also the process integration. We've already talked about pad drilling and the effects of that. That's all through process integration and changing that we've got. There's also processes in understanding the formations that we're in and how we drill them. Back in 2000, we had some wells that we drilled up in Montana. They were Bakken wells, which is an oil-producing formation that's very prolific. In those wells, when we first started drilling them, it took us 45 to 50 days to drill them. We were drilling 10,000 feet down and 10,000 feet over. Within about 2 years, 3 years time frame, we had those wells where we were drilling them in 18 days. That affects our environmental imprint. That affects the cost of drilling the wells. That affects everything that we're doing as we move forward. There's also the technology piece of it. When you start looking at the ability to take chemistries and affecting the produced fluids that we have that are coming out of well bores, we are making great strides in our ability to take these fluids and reuse them in an industry. That's going to cut down on the amount of fluids that we have to withdraw to do the work that we do. It's also going to cut down on disposal issues and things like that. And, again, this is an evolution. We're not where we want to be yet, but we're making great strides in all these areas. There's also a side of things where we can take the drill cuttings and the muds that are coming back and return to the surface, where we can actually take these fluids and in the future we'll be able to turn those into alternate construction materials, taking these materials today that we'd normally have to dispose of, but turning them into something that you may make highways out of or something like that going down the road. And one of the other pieces on the mechanical side is the physical ability to change the way that we do things on the surface. And that's, we've got a process called CleanStream that you'll be hearing more about. It's under development, and we've actually got a couple of units in the field. But what we're doing is we're using ultraviolet light to actually process the water as it's coming in for a frac treatment. The bacteria that's in there will hurt the gel systems that we use. It'll destroy their ability to carry the proppant and everything downhole. And also certain bacteria, when they get in the formation, will do damage to the formation. So one of the chemicals that we have to use is a biocide. Well, what we're trying to do is take the mechanical ways to actually remove that out of the system, all right? And we've got some actual field trials. We'll have about 10 units that we'll deploy into the field this year. But the whole key is that this thing is a massive evolution that's been going on. It's not any one piece. It covers a broad group of technical activities. And my question is how are we going to allow the next 100 years of evolution to be able to evolve the way it has over the last 190 years? And I think the answer is fairly straightforward. When you look at this, we've got to put sustainable development in place, and it's got to have teeth in it. We've got to have open dialogues with groups like this to where we can actually understand what the issues and concerns are and work through the issues in a very formal and scientific way to get the answers that we need to. We definitely need to continue the technology piece. Everybody here today has talked about technology. We don't need to stifle that. We need to allow it to grow the way that it always had. We need to develop a supplier base that's able to react on a national basis but is also local and working in the communities that we're in. And then finally, at the end of the day, we've got to be able to, especially as an industry, we've got to be able to interface closer with the communities that we live in. And if we do all this, I think the evolution's gonna go. Now, personally, I'm an engineer. I've been in the industry about 30 years, and I can't wait to see what's around the corner. We've got a lot of exciting opportunities for us. So with that, I'll say thank you.
Okay, thank you. Those are the three elements that form the sort of pillars of the system. What I would like to do right now is take a few minutes to talk about how those elements interact and how the system works, to give you an idea of a couple of the dynamics that we think are important for the U.S. natural gas system and going forward. What it might mean and why it's important to understand some of these things. So I've only got about four slides. Okay. Key takeaways that I would want you to think about is one is all these wells are different, as Jen pointed out, and that's a really important factor when it comes to thinking about production in the future. As Jen alluded to, this year we don't need LNG, we don't want LNG, but we're going to get it anyway. My own belief is that at least for the near term, 2010, 11, and maybe 12, we can't have a price over $6.50 because it kicks into gear several factors which undermine it. However, I do believe that the medium term is increasingly bullish. When I say bullish, and most of these comments are going to be from the industry perspective because I generally work with producers. Consumers is a different and usually opposite story. Now, the one thing I think is important, the name of this conference is the normalization of unconventional natural gas, okay? And that's very important because I see us as having hit an inflection point and things have changed. The good old days, you had very cheap gas all through the 90s. You had gas bubbles that are being worn through, right? Then you hit a period of high prices, the Glorious Revolution, and, had all of these characteristics. It was the consumers that cried uncle. You had enormous breakthrough technological gains thanks to Mike and his peers. It was about the rate of adding plays. As Velo says, if he had done his talk 5 years ago, 6 years ago, it would have been the magnificent one, two?
Two.
All right. Now we're up to seven, and you can see he's getting to eight, nine, ten. So the point is not necessarily to think about the plays that are in place now, although they're very important. It's how fast can we add them, when will we add them, and why will we add them. The debt and equity markets during this period, as my financial friends can tell you, was open to everyone who had even some experience. And company creation was the name of the game. A lot of new companies founded. We believe we've hit an inflection point, and for the next little while, you have this hangover period. You had your party. and certainly from an industry perspective, virtually all of those factors may reverse. Okay? So this is an interesting time to be here. I don't think of, you know, post-revolutionary periods, it's not so much like the American Revolution where you go on, you build a country. It's more like the French Revolution with the Reign of Terror, because a lot of companies are going to have a lot of problems. There's an important aspect of the overall system that I think is important to remember. The most surprising thing that happened in 2009, at least in my opinion, was that everyone was wrong about the durability of supply. If you go back a year from now and talk to people, everyone would have said, look, the decline rate for the U.S. natural gas system is about 28%. If I don't drill a well from January 1st to December 31st, my production will fall 28%. That's true. You're on a very fast treadmill. We cut the rig count in half, okay? And so everyone expected production to go into screaming decline. It didn't happen. And one of the things that's very important, and Jen alluded to this too, is on variability. The system in the United States is carried by a relatively small number of good wells, okay, and a very large number of very poor wells. Okay, so you can see from this graph, this is just very simple, the percentage of my wells drilled and the percentage of its initial production, but you can think of it as production added. So 100 obviously gets you 100 if all wells were the same. The point is they're not the same. The lines are the actual wells drilled. My point is that roughly 20% of wells provide 70% of new production. So when the well count fell in half, it didn't do a whole lot. Okay? And I'll go into this a little bit more. What happened in this year, and pay careful attention because I've done the animation myself. I've got a graph here. And what I'm trying to show is something related to averages and the flaw of averages, if you will. Let's imagine if you had a basketball team that had five people on it, and all of a sudden you're allowed to bring the team up to 50 people. In fact, you're forced to. What will happen to the average skill level of the team? It's going down, right? Going down. That's what happened here. It's economics 101. It's declining marginal productivity. If you look at this graph, I've got the number of new wells, so that's activity level, versus the median over this time period, sort of steady state. And then the other one is well productivity. So let's take a look at what happened, starting in 2000. Okay, as you added more, you are getting into this period I call the death spiral. I have less than normal activity, and I have declining productivity. This is bad. This is basin exhaustion. Then I raise activity. Why? Because price is going up, right? So, boom. For 3 years, I raise activity. This is completely normal. Declining marginal returns. Every well I add is worse than the one that I was drilling before. Then what happened is, well, hey, actually, let me bring in this, is the marginal cost cycle. So you have a change in productivity. Productivity goes down. What does that mean in terms of the number of wells I need to drill? That goes up. What does that do to service sector adequacy? It makes it more limited, creates bottlenecks, which brings cost up. Okay, this is a vicious cycle. And this is what happened as costs skyrocketed. Okay, then we had Mike and his team come in there, and look at what happened here. It's incredible. This is breakthrough, because at higher than normal levels of activity, all of a sudden, my average wells were getting much, much, much better. Okay, this is, and that last data point, by the way, is 2008. This is when production began to surge. Now, in 2009, when we dropped the count, we drilled 42% less wells, 42%, okay? But think about what happened to the, the well average shot up. So average productivity in 2009 was tremendously high, okay? Again, it's a high grading effect. And importantly, when that happens, the vicious cycle turns to a virtuous cycle. Your well productivity increases, which means you need fewer wells, which means there's service sector adequacy, all right, and spare capacity, which means prices go down. So we've reversed that cycle. And Jen was alluding to the fact that we may be getting to a point where it's going to go back to a vicious cycle. And then lastly, I'd just like to talk a little bit about the medium term. When I think of the medium term, Velo outlined how much resource is there. It's tremendous. It's huge. and Jen talked about the improving economics, and Mike talked about the improving technology. In the medium term, though, because I feel like we're in this post-revolutionary phase, I'm a little more bullish on prices. First of all, there's a policy impact. I believe that lack of policy favors gas, okay? Mainly because nobody wants to build a coal plant, okay? If you look at the coal plants on the drawing board, they stay there and they stay there. They're not built, and then eventually somebody has to do something, and the default is natural gas. Second thing is that policy is, I think, in the end, going to favor natural gas. Why? Because four things, in my view, are important on policy in the United States when you're talking about energy. It has to meet all four of these, or it doesn't have to, but it's good if it can meet all four of these objectives. Gas is the only one that can meet all of those objectives. So by default, either because of overreach and failure or by intentional action, I think gas stands a good chance of being favored. And the last thing is, in the medium term, the point is we're not done with the cycle. Cycle's not dead. It goes back to Jen's graph that shows all those plays. The point is we're in a phase right now where we're not being very active about adding the new ones, about bringing Velo's Magnificent 7 up to a Magnificent 10 or 12. Okay? Why? Because now prices are not incentivizing that. Okay? But as we cease to look intensively for those kind of things, the plays that are there, they are finite, and they will start to reach the ratty edges. Take a look at this. This is the Barnett Shale, and I know this is hard to see, but just look at the colors. The red dots are where we drilled in 2003. The yellow dots are where we drilled in 2005, and the green dots in 2007. So what do you see? In 2003, we were focused on a particular area, and then in 2005 and 2007, everybody went everywhere into the 12-county area because everyone was looking for another sweet spot. Now let's take a look at the well results. Here it is. In this one, the green is good. Okay, dark green are very good wells, and light green are pretty good wells. The red wells are not good. So when we went to the 12-county area, my point of this is that you didn't find much outside of the core area that you're originally in and the new core area. The only reason you're not drilling between those two is, by the way, it's called Fort Worth. Okay. But the point is, all these plays have top-tier acreage, as Jen showed in her Haynesville map, and secondary areas. And eventually, you will get to the end of this. Okay. Now, it's a deep inventory. Okay. I'm just talking about for the very long term, for policy reasons, that kind of thing. But I just wanted to point that out, that we'll be in a cycle where you stop defining plays and you focus on what you have. You get continuing incremental technology gains, but eventually you probably have to go back to the well to make all those other plays, all those shale plays that Mike had on his map that we're not even touching really, economic. Okay, and that's a process of giving the price incentive and having a system which goes out and gets them. So those are my remarks. I'd like to go ahead and move to some questions now. And please, again, wait for a microphone. Say who you are. And then make sure your question is a question, and we'll try to get some answers or make them up on the spot. I think we have one right there.
Mark Breifogel. I run a small hedge fund, let's call it, here in Washington. Question for Jen. You had a nice plot of gas consumption with a dip in it. When new coal plants are coming online, you also made the statement that gas pipeline was overbuilt right now. My question is more about gas on coal competition. Are pipelines running into areas where the predominant electrical source is coal? And at the end of the day, will natural gas be, figuratively speaking, eating coal's lunch for electrical production?
All right, this will work. Essentially what we saw in 2009 is that even though our overall power generation loads were falling, weighted down by the recession, gas demand from the power sector actually held flat because our prices sank to the point that gas outcompeted coal in the southeast. And essentially we added about, in our estimates, and there are a lot of different estimates out there and no good way to do the counterfactual, we'd estimate that we gained about 2 BCF per day of gas demand by displacing coal along the Atlantic coast. We displaced Central Appalachian coal, older inefficient plants. Our feeling this year is that with a slightly stronger price expectation because of the reduction in storage, because of the fact that we're going into a slight decline in overall production, the economy's growing, gas is going to be in a less competitive position relative to coal. And our price expectations, similar to the NYMEX right now, right around $5 per MMBTU for the year. And the fact is that at $5 per MMBTU, you're simply not competitive with coal, even though we're seeing a little bit of rumblings in the coal market, and we've got a met market that's really moved up strongly. In order to compete for that coal load, we really have to see gas prices drop down into the 450 per MMBTU range, down into the 425 per MMBTU range. And coal, because it's got very sticky costs, because so much of its costs are associated with labor, cap coal prices can't necessarily decline to fight for that load with gas. Our expectation is that there's certainly the possibility that gas eats coal's lunch again in 2010, but it would be very painful for the gas industry if we went through another year in which average prices moved down toward that 425 per MMBTU range. But the place in which gas is definitely out-competing coal is for future generation requirements. And indeed, we've got 20 gigawatts of new coal capacity being added between 2009 and 2012. But after that, the economics favor gas so completely that it's the end of the new coal build for, you know, five to 10 years before we start talking about potentially coal with carbon sequestration. The big question that we're watching right now is the degree to which the old unscrubbed coal plants are under enough pressure to potentially retire, and we're seeing a number of announcements around decisions by Duke, Exelon, Georgia Power, Southern Company, to retire older coal units and replace them with gas, but it just doesn't happen quickly enough to really firm up the market till 2012, 2013, because these old coal plants tend to be in places that they're needed for reliability and for load support. So it's not necessarily the adequacy of the gas pipeline infrastructure. It's more the power transmission makeup that possibly limits the pace of that change.
I'm Bob Hirsch from MISI. One of the issues that we're facing these days has to do with how much gas there is for the long term. And we hear this 100-year number, and I wonder if the panelists could comment on how long we will be able to have shale gas at reasonable prices.
Unreasonable. Yeah. Because different people have very different ideas, but I'll let Velo handle that.
Oh, thanks. It's a great question, Bob. in our view, we incorporate into our forecasts and outlooks progress in technology, which you saw some examples of that Jen showed. We see a continuation of that continuing. And with that, much of the resource that today might require $8, $9, $10 will come back down to this $7 type of target. And so I always like to put in the fundamental resource that's there, and it's quite large. The 3,000 or so is actually a fairly conservative number. We'll be able to work into that large resource over time, and with that, I think we can have, in my view, affordable prices for some time in the future, 20, 30, 40 years or so.
The only thing I would add is that I don't think geologically there's a question. I think the question is, will the components of the system work to allow this to bring costs down and to bring it out of the ground? I think the above-ground risks are much higher than the below-ground risk.
Yeah, one other thing is we sometimes worry about growing pains, and especially over the next few years, and, you know, depending on how aggressively we retire coal or, you know, potentially look at carbon caps, and we look at the possible dislocations coming from an industry that's in, you know, really a period of retrenchment, looks to be the case for 2009-10, and we'd say for 2011, in which we're seeing an industry that's very focused on top prospects and in core areas of these new shales, to a period in which we have to call on the higher cost plays and have to call in a good bit of labor and service capacity to access them. I think in a kind of steady state growth phase, we're fine and we've got the resource base, but nonetheless, we could be exposed to some cost pressures and some growing pains, and specifically the deeper the price depths hit over the next couple of years, you know, depending on the weather, depending on what the economy does, the more painful those growing pains could be. But nonetheless, it doesn't mean a long-term challenge with the resource base. It is simply that, growing pains. Watch it from a policy standpoint.
Thanks. Joel Cobb, Department of State. You didn't mention methane hydrates, I think it is. Is that because it's just too much of an unknown, or because we don't think it'll add too much to the supply, especially given the current cost environment? And secondly, what kind of CO2 levels are we seeing in the natural gas that's coming from these unconventional plays? And is there any reason to believe that sequestration in those same formations is easier or harder than it is in traditional production of natural gas?
We looked at the methane hydrates starting in the early 80s, and finally, we basically have stopped looking because fundamentally, and Jan and I had this discussion, it's a endothermic process. Basically, it requires the input of energy as opposed to an exothermic process. And so with that, you really, the system, even by drawing pressure, will close on you if you don't continue to put in energy into it. So it's quite a ways out there, particularly given its locations and the basic fundamentals of the process itself. Clearly a large resource, deserves some work. If we can find some ways to develop low-cost energy, then yes, it might become productive, but probably into a different marketplace. Your second question was the CO2 content. Many of these plays have relatively zero or no CO2 content. However, something like the Horned River Basin, it has something like a 10% CO2 content. The Antrim Shale, toward the end of its life, might have 15, 20% type of CO2 content. One approach, of course, is to actually take that CO2 and put it back into the reservoir to enhance the displacement of the methane, very much like you might do in a coal seam as part of enhanced oil recovery. That's still at the very leading edge of research work, but based on work that we've done, we think it has very high potential.
Question up here. Can we get a mic?
Lou Pularisi, Energy Policy Research Foundation. The cost discussions were fantastic. Let me just ask you, no one talked about taxes, and the president's budget says that we have excessive investment in oil and gas and that we should go to a more neutral regime, presumably use this money for something else. And so I'm sort of curious whether you've looked at whether repeal of the deduction in domestic manufacturing, the 199 provisions, and then the eliminating of the expensing for intangible drilling costs and even depletion allowance, whether those affect the cost performance of the shale plays.
I guess that's I'm going to say it's something that we're looking into, but I'll give you a tax quote that I have some more solid data on, which is, you know, we've been asked a lot about certainly the severance tax in Pennsylvania and what that could do to development break-evens. And we're, you know, on the graphic I showing the development break-even costs, we've got, you know, Marcellus has been great. The wells have been fantastic. The permitting backlogs have been cleared a little faster, I think, than the industry expected. And we've got, you know, a group of different, you know, southwestern Pennsylvania, north-central Pennsylvania producers and well programs in different stages of development. We've got an overall development break even for Marcellus around $4 per MMBTU. The kind of severance tax that Governor Rendell's talking about now in 4 to 5% range could add about 40 cents to that development break even cost. So that gives you some reference on what, you know, different tax regimes could do. But I can't give you any specific quotes on the potential federal changes. The other interesting thing we watched was TransCanada went through a big rate change starting January 1st because their flows had been declining, and it had a real impact on the competitiveness of Horn River Basin. basically disadvantaged Horn River Basin by about 20 cents just because of that rate change. So I guess the thing is, this is a real kind of competitive market shaping up. I mean, you saw all those plays in a $4 to $5 break-even stack, and the policy implications are tremendous in terms of advantaging or disadvantaging different plays or producers.
Oh, one thing I would just point out real quickly is there's a real trade-off here in terms of taxing the industry and the activity level. Will taxes impact price? Yeah, definitely. Okay, I mean, it's fairly simple math. The price will eventually be pushed through because the industry will push it through, and returns, their returns will be bid down again. But one thing that's interesting is the U.S. has a fairly favorable regime toward this vis-a-vis other countries. But about 80% of every well drilled in the world is drilled in the United States or Canada. Okay, so you're getting vast sort of job creation and vast sort of activity and technology gains and all those benefits from these, you know, tax breaks. So it's a trade-off, right?
Lulu Fauzi from Energy Information Administration. I'm wondering whether you take in consideration the liquid associated to developing shale gas and whether it will change your assessment of, you know, the cost estimate in the future.
Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. The liquids are most definitely attracting aggressive development in certain plays. The Eagle Ford and is definitely attractive because of the liquids content in Granite Wash. We're working the liquids into our economics, and certainly they're, you know, a key driver going forward. And some plays are economic based on that liquid stream.
Let me just add to that, particularly in the high liquids portions of Eagle Ford and some of the other plays, the marginal cost of gas, very much like thinking about it as an LNG where you can also have liquids, is actually quite low if you basically price the product as a crude, and then the natural gas really comes along almost as a byproduct. It does affect the economics tremendously, and yes, all of the plays we look at have that built in.
Give Adam a chance to call it. Good. One last question. Adam, did you have a question?
Sure. One, Adam Smensky, Deutsche Bank. One quick comment. The type of tax is very important. Removing tax preference items that encourage production doesn't have the right impact. I mean, you know, if you're looking for more gas, the severance tax in Pennsylvania, I think, is very interesting. I've talked to people in the industry who say, you know, they like that idea. They pay severance taxes in Texas and Louisiana and Oklahoma and a lot of other states, and if Harrisburg was getting some money from production, that might actually encourage the state of Pennsylvania to move more quickly on some of the other things that the industry would like. So, Raul, the question is for you, but if Mike wants to jump in at some point, the Bob Simon actually used the term witch's brew for fracturing fluids. And I don't think he believes it is. In fact, he went on to say that he didn't think that there was a problem. And people at the EPA have said there isn't a problem. Texas and other states that have been doing this for a half a century or longer say that there isn't a problem. But this is a if you have people talking about witch's brew rather than talking about clean, you know, development opportunities, it seems to me that it's something that's got to be addressed. And so what's PFC Energy doing to advise its company clients as to how they might turn that perception around in places like New York State and elsewhere? Thank you.
Right. Well, it's difficult to fight people that are scared and don't have a lot of experience in doing this. And, you know, Are there real issues? Well, let's find out. I mean, I think everybody is on board with that. This is generally not a problem. It's more a problem in the Marcellus and Northeast. And in those states, you don't have much familiarity. You also have a lot of split estates where, you know, somebody owns the surface rights and not the mineral rights, and they're not getting any benefit from this. So, you know, it's very difficult, and that's why we feel that that play actually has pretty high above ground risk. Mike, what are you guys doing?
You know, when I look at this just as an individual walking on this planet, and on one side I see the concerns that people have out there, and those concerns to them are genuine. I don't think that they're based on facts necessarily, but I know that those concerns are genuine. And so the real piece of the industry is how do you get the factual information out there? How do you get it to where people understand the information? Because, you know, just as the slides that we showed today, I just skimmed the top of the iceberg. So there's a lot of technical things that happen that's out there. So I understand that concern. I also understand that, you know, our company spends $40 to $50 million a year on the development of frack widgets, and we want to continue to do that. And if we stop the ability for our company to protect the goods that we do, then it's also a real concern. So we've got to find a balance in there. And I think there are some rules out there that allow us. Colorado Rule 205, for example, is a great rule that allows the state of Colorado to understand what the chemistries that we pump that are out there that take some of the witch's brew out of the equations. New York State's got a groove going where we've supplied them information. But the key to it is the protection of the confidential business information. So I think as an industry, we've got to work harder at educating. It was the last bullet that I had on my last slide about sustainability, and that's working with the communities that we're in, getting the right message out there. That's there. I know that Halliburton as a company has got genuine concerns. We want to address these issues. We want to talk about them. We want to be able to hit them head on. That's out there. We don't have anything to hide behind. At the end of the day, we want to address these moving forward. So,
okay, good. Well, it's time to break now. If we can meet back here at 10 till, that would be great. Thanks. And I guess we'll stay up here if people want to ask questions.